morning. Welcome to Christ Church. My name is Paul Wilson. I'm one of the pastors here, and we're in week two of a series entitled Worldview. And what we're doing this month is we're looking at a lot of the major religions around the world, as well as some of the faith-based groups that are here, right here in the United States. We're trying to ask ourselves this question: what can we learn from these people of other faiths? And then how can we learn more about what they believe? So ultimately, we'll be able to have confidence in having a conversation with them, being able to engage them about spiritual things. So ultimately, we can share the love and message of Jesus Christ with every single person we come in contact with. Well, this week we're looking at the faith of Islam. Now, my guess is that many of you are saying, I really don't know anybody of Islamic faith, or I don't have a whole lot of Muslim friends. There's not a lot of Muslim people living here in the U.S., as we'll talk about in just a moment. But overall, it's still important to understand what this faith is all about, because this is the second largest religion in the entire world. There's over 1.3 billion people that are of Muslim faith today. To give some comparison, Christianity has just a little over 2 billion people. So you can see that the Islamic faith is a huge faith, many people around the world, and it's a fast-growing faith as well, especially in the eastern part of the world. It's growing rapidly. Well, as we begin, I want you to watch this video from a man who's a leader in a local Islamic mosque here, as he kind of details to you what are some of the basics of his faith. So watch this video.
Hello, my name is Osama Shami. This is Islamic Community Center of Phoenix. I am the chairman of the board of trustees for the mosque. Muslim faith is an Abrahamic faith, which we basically trace the faith to the prophet Abraham. We believe that all the messengers came from God, and all of them, they had the same message. We believe that Prophet Muhammad is a direct descendant of Ishmael, who's the son of Abraham. So the religion comes from the same source as Christianity or Judaism. They come from the same God. We have very similar tenets in the Muslim faith as in the Christian and Jewish faith. The Islam has two parts. One of them is the belief, and then the second one is the actions. So the core of the belief is the oneness of God, to believe in the angels, messengers, the books, which is the revelations, and to believe in the day of judgment, and to believe in God's will. Whatever is gonna happen is willed by Allah. That's the belief section. The action section has to do with deeds, which are summarized in five deeds. One of them is testifying that there is no God except Allah and Muhammad is his messenger. And then establishing prayer, paying charities or alms, fasting the month of Ramadan, and then performing pilgrimage once in a lifetime. Jesus is mentioned in various chapters of the Holy Book. And Muslims believe that Jesus was another prophet, similar to Moses and similar to Noah. He came from miraculous birth through his mother, the Virgin Mary. And we believe that his creation is miraculous, similar to the creation of Adam, who was created from dust. He didn't have a father or a mother. In the case of Jesus, he had, peace be upon him, he had a mother, but with no father, and his mother was a virgin. He's one of the five great prophets that was mentioned in the Quran, and we believe that he was a prophet. He came with the same message as other prophets came with, which is to call people to the one God, to worshiping the one God. No, we don't believe in the divinity of Christ. We believe that Christ, like other prophets, he was a man. That he was sent by God. Now, there is, and I know there is the issue of crucifixion. We don't believe that crucifixion happened. We believe that Jesus was lifted up to heaven by God, And we believe in the second coming of Jesus. And the three monotheistic religions, the Christianity, Judaism, and Islam, they all wait and expect the second coming of Christ. So we share the same belief in the second coming. But we don't believe in the divinity of Christ. We don't believe that he was the Son of God. We don't believe that he was crucified for the sins of humanity. Those are specific beliefs to the Christian belief, but in Muslim belief, we believe that he was a man, a prophet like Moses was, and like Noah was, and like Abraham was. Christians and Jews have a special class with respect to Muslims, because they believe that Muslims believe that Christians and Jews, these are people of the book, and that's how they are described in the Quran. These are people who revelation came down upon them, and so we respect what they believe in. We think that the belief came from the same source. We believe that probably the message got distorted through the years, but we still believe that the Bible is a holy book that contains a revelation from God. We believe that the Torah is a holy book that contains a revelation of God. And we also believe that the prophets that the Jews had and the prophet of Christianity, they're all prophets of God.
So there you have some of the basic beliefs of an American Muslim person. Throughout the course of what we're talking here, I'm going to try to share with you some of the differences when it's what the Western Muslims believe versus the Eastern Muslims believe. But overall, we're going to go through some of the basics. And first, I want to start by talking about the history. Where did the Islamic faith begin? What is its origins? Where does it start? Interestingly enough, Islam, Judaism, and Christianity all share basically the same beginning, the same story. They all look to the Bible. They all look to the book of Genesis as God created the heavens and the earth, and then with Adam, and then with Noah, and then Abraham. Remember last week when we talked about Abraham, he's considered the father of the Jews. But you remember God made a promise to Abraham, a covenant, an oath to him, saying, I will turn you into a great nation. Your descendants will be as numerous as the sand on the seashore. And all peoples on earth will be blessed through you. And so that father Abraham is not only the father of the Jews, but of all nations, of all religions, all faiths, because it says that all people on earth will be blessed through him. And the Muslim people believe in Abraham as well as one of their prophets. Well, let me kind of fill you in on the story of what happened next with Abraham and his sons. You see, Abraham was married to a lady named Sarah, and they believed that God was going to bless them. They believed that God was going to give them children the way that he said that he would. But after a few years went by and they weren't able to have kids, they started to get worried. Then a few more years went by and more years, and eventually it had been 20, 30 years, and Sarah and Abraham were not able to have kids, and they felt like they were never going to be able to have kids. So they started to take matters into their own hands. And Sarah at that time said to Abraham, here's what I want you to do. I want you to go ahead and sleep with my handmaiden. Her name was Hagar. She was an Egyptian slave that was property of Sarah. And she said, I want you to sleep with my handmaiden, and then when she has a kid, that child will become my child, and I will raise it as one of our own. Now, Abraham did what any man would do in that situation. He listened to his wife, right? You know, if you want me to sleep with her, all right, I'll go ahead and do that. Just kidding. But Abraham did do that. He listened to his wife. He slept with Hagar, and she became pregnant. And as she became pregnant, her and Sarah started to have some anger and some tension with one another, and there was a son that was going to be born to Hagar. And listen as the Bible tells us about that story. It's found in the book of Genesis, chapter 16, verses 11 through 12. And this is the story of Ishmael, and here's what it says. The angel of the Lord also said to her, now you are with child, and you will have a son. You shall name him Ishmael, for the Lord has heard of your misery. He will be a wild donkey of a man. His hand will be against everyone, and everyone's hand against him. And he will live in hostility toward all of his brothers. This is the story in the beginning of this man named Ishmael. And Ishmael is known as the father of the Muslim people to this day. They trace their lineage all the way from Muhammad all the way back through Ishmael. And he was the son of Abraham and of Hagar. Now, the Bible records here that Ishmael was going to have a pretty difficult life, that there was always going to be a lot of fighting, a lot of hostility between him and his brothers. And sure enough, this hostility started up in his family as Sarah and Hagar started to really not like each other. As Sarah wanted this child for her own, but Hagar was the real mother. And there was a lot of difficulty regarding the two of them. And God started to get frustrated with Abraham and Sarah because he said, you know what, you didn't listen to me. You weren't patient. You didn't wait for me. I had a plan in this whole thing, and it wasn't that Ishmael would be the next descendant. It was, Sarah, that you were going to have a child of your own if you just would have waited for me. And the Bible picks up the story in Genesis chapter 17, verses 20 and 21, and it says this, "And as for Ishmael, I have heard you. I will surely bless him. I will make him fruitful and will greatly increase his numbers. He will be the father of 12 rulers, and I will make him into a great nation. But my covenant I will establish with Isaac, whom Sarah will bear to you by this time next year." God said to Abraham and Sarah, you are going to have a son of your own, and you are to name him Isaac, and he will be the one that will continue on this promise, this covenant, this oath I made with you. It will be his descendants whom I will bless and will be this great nation that I will build into. But he said, Ishmael, I haven't forgotten about him. I won't abandon him. He too will grow into a great nation, and I will take care of him. And sure enough, that's what happened. There was this disturbance, this fighting, and when Isaac was finally born, Ishmael and his mom Hagar were kind of kicked off to the side, and they moved south and to the east to the area of Saudi Arabia, and there he grew up, and there he became the father of a great nation. Many of the Arab nations today trace their lineage all the way back through Ishmael. And it was at this point in history that the story between the Islamic faith, the Christian faith, and the Jewish faith started to change, and the paths started to diverge and go in two different directions because of what the Islamic people believe about Ishmael versus what the Jews and the Christians believe about Isaac. Now, the rest of the story goes like this. God said in the book of Genesis, I want you to take Abraham, your son Isaac, take him up to this mountain called Mount Moriah, and I want you to sacrifice him there just to show me and prove to me how much you really are willing to follow me now and serve me. And so Abraham did that, took his son all the way up there, and when he was about to sacrifice his son, God said, no, you don't have to do that. I believe in you. I trust you. I know that you are a man who wants to follow after my heart. So I will spare your son. Thank you for being fully obedient to me. And that's what Christians believe. That's what Jews believe. However, Muslims believe the story is a little bit different. They believe that God asked Abraham to sacrifice Ishmael, not Isaac. And the place that they did that today is what's known as the Kaaba stone. It's the most holy site in all of Islamic faith. And it's on this location that they believe that's the place where God asked Abraham to sacrifice Ishmael and not Isaac. And later they believe the same thing happened like with Isaac, that God spared him and didn't ask him to sacrifice him at the last moment. And they believe that Abraham and Ishmael built kind of a sanctuary there to worship God. And in this place, there was this stone they believe that fell down from heaven, kind of like a black meteorite. It's called the Black Stone. And it is there to this day. And if you look on the screen right now, you'll see a picture of what it looks like in modern day times. You can see the people and how small they are compared to that cube. The word Kaaba in Arabic literally means cube or square. And inside of that huge square is where the black stone is. And many of the most revered Muslim leaders are allowed to go in there, and they're to pay homage at that stone. They kiss that stone the same way they believe that Muhammad did hundreds of years before them. They trade out the covering over that stone surface there once a year in a special ceremony. But this place and this location is very important to Muslims. Like I said, it's their most holy site. So this is what happened with Isaac and Ishmael and how the two stories diverged. But at this point in time, there wasn't Muslims. There wasn't the Islamic faith during this time. This is just now how they recount their story, how they tell it. But again, up to this point, there would be no one who would be considered a Muslim person. In fact, the Muslim faith didn't officially start for thousands of years later until a man named Muhammad came on the scene. And Muhammad was born almost 600 years after Jesus Christ. He was born in the city of Mecca in 570 AD, and he died in 632 in the city of Medina, which is modern-day Saudi Arabia. And Muhammad is the last prophet, is what the Islamic people believe, that was someone who spoke God's message to his people, and he is the founder of the modern-day Islamic faith. It was after his life that this faith started to take root and then grow. Let me kind of give you an understanding of what was going on culturally in Muhammad's life around that time, around 600 AD in the country of Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia at this point in history was a very polytheistic country. In other words, the people there believed in multiple gods. They believed in the god of the rain, god of the sun, god of the stars, god of the grass and the animals, gods of commerce, gods of business. All these different gods they worshipped. And many of the different cities in Saudi Arabia would have a tribe that would govern that tribe. And that tribe would pick one particular god that they would worship, and they'd make an idol, or they'd make a shrine, and they would worship that. Now, the city of Mecca was strategically located along the Arabian Peninsula. It was where all the trade routes went. Anyone who was traveling and trading goods had to go through the city of Mecca. And at Mecca was this location where the Kaaba stone was, this stone that fell from heaven. And so that was revered as a holy site. They felt like it was something that God had given them. What many of the tribes did, whenever they would come through Mecca, they would take one of their idols or one of their shrines, and they would place it somewhere near the Kaaba stone. And that became kind of the center place in all of Saudi Arabia for worshiping gods and all kinds of different gods. And it was an area where no one would war against one another because they considered it kind of a religious and holy place and site. This was the context and the culture in which Muhammad grew up. Well, Muhammad was born into a very difficult situation. When he was born, before he was born, his father died, and he was born into a very poor family. His father was just a poor man, barely trying to make it, and died before Muhammad was even born. And then 6 years later, Muhammad's mother died, and he had to go and live with his grandmother and grandfather. They raised him for a few more years, and then they died. Very difficult time for him. Then he came to live with his uncle. Fortunately for him, his uncle was more of a middle-class merchant, and his uncle taught him more about business and commerce, how to take care of himself, and he lived with him through his teenage years until his early 20s when Muhammad went out on his own, and he went to work for a local businessman, a very wealthy businessman and well-known one in the town of that day in Mecca. Muhammad learned from him, learned about business, learned about finance, was starting to kind of make it a little bit, and then another interesting fact happened. Muhammad's businessman that he worked for, he died. And his wife, his widow who was left behind, her name was Khadijah. At the time, she was 40 years old. She did something that was very unheard of in that culture of that day. She said, "Muhammad, I want to marry you. I want you to become my husband and take over for my husband who has just died." He was 25 years of age at the time, and he was a pretty smart guy. He saw this opportunity. He said, "All right, marry a rich lady. I'm all for it." And so he married Khadijah, and he was set from that time on. He didn't have to really work anymore. The business was taking care of itself. And he started to turn his attention from business and finance now to philosophical things. In Saudi Arabia at that time, there were a few Christians, there were a few Jewish people, and he started to have conversations with these people, started to learn about them and understand that they believed that there was only one true God, that there weren't all these multiple gods that you were to worship like he had been raised to believe. And this got him really thinking about that, and he wondered if that was correct or if what he believed was always correct. And then at age 40, he claims that he was met by the angel Gabriel, the same Gabriel from the Bible, who came to him and said, "Muhammad, I have a message from God to you. And here is the message, that you are to worship God alone. You are not to worship all these other gods. And in fact, I want you to be my messenger to destroy all these other idols, destroy all these other gods, and unite the Arabian Peninsula all around the belief in one God alone." And so Muhammad believed that was now his purpose, that was his calling, that was his mission in life. But he knew this was going to be very difficult because in his country, the worship of all these gods was very tied to their political system, was also very tied to their commerce and their business and their financial situation. But anyway, he decided, I've got to share this message. I've got to do what God wanted me to do. So at age 43, he began to preach in the city of Mecca that there is only one true God. You need to get rid of all these other gods. And this was not a popular thing that he was saying. In fact, very few people came to his side and joined up with him. And the town got so sick of him preaching this message year after year that when he was 52 years of age in 622 AD, he was forced out of Mecca. They kicked him out of town and said, "Get out of here. We don't believe in what you're saying." So he fled with just only a few followers to a city to the north called Medina. And there, the people there were more open to his message, were more open to this belief in just one true God. And over the course of the next 3 years, he amassed a group of 10,000 followers in the city of Medina. It was then that he felt like it was time to go back to Mecca, go back to where he remembered God calling him and try to convince his people one more time. So he went back to Mecca with these 10,000 followers, and sure enough, war broke out amongst his beliefs and the beliefs of everyone else in Mecca. Muhammad and his followers ended up winning that war, and over the last few years of his life, he conquered and united all of the Arabian Peninsula, gathering over 1,000 followers to this brand new faith, the faith that we know today as Islam. And that kind of gives you the beginning of Muhammad, his life, his story, and how Islam came about. Now what I want to share with you are some of the basic beliefs of the Islamic faith. Just keeping it kind of simple, there's only about five or six main things that we need to understand and cover. The first one is the belief that there is just one God and one God alone. Their name for God is Allah. That's the Arabic for the word Allah, is for God. And they're very huge on this fact and this point. It's their most important belief, that there are no other gods, one God alone. Now, sometimes people have been led to believe that the God of Islam and the God of Judaism, the God of Christianity is all the same God. And in some ways it is, but in some ways it's a little bit different, their belief. They believe that God is very detached from his creation, that he's so powerful, so strong, so mighty, so wise, so far above human beings that he cannot be comprehended by them, that he's a very impersonal God, a very detached God. Now, Christians would say that it's kind of the exact opposite, that we believe and we see all throughout our Bible that God is interacting with his creation. He wants to have a friendship with human beings that he has created. He created them for that purpose, and he's been interacting with them throughout history. So that's one of the main differences between Islamic faith and Christian faith, is their belief in God. The second thing that we share is a belief in angels. Muslims believe there are angels. In fact, they believe Gabriel is the highest of all the good angels, and that Shaitan is the highest of all the bad angels, or the demons. And that name is very similar to our name for Satan. Another interesting belief they have about angels is that every single person, they believe, is assigned two angels to be with them all throughout their life. Now, these aren't guardian angels like some people believe in, but instead, these are like eternal scorekeepers. There's one angel that keeps track of all of your good deeds, all the good things that you do throughout your life, how much you follow the Quran, follow the teachings of Muhammad in the Islamic faith. Another angel keeps track of all your bad deeds, all of the times that you've disobeyed the Quran, you've gone against the will of God. And so you go out throughout your life with these angels keeping score of your life. And we'll talk about why that's important in just a minute. They also believe in a lot of the same prophets that we hold dear in our Bible. Adam, Noah, Abraham, Moses. And you remember hearing the man on the video at the beginning saying they even believe in Jesus. They believe that Jesus was a man, a real human being, that he was a prophet from God, that he was trying to bring people back to a one true God. But what they believe differently than we do about Jesus is they do not believe that Jesus was the Son of God. They believe he was not divine. That what we read in our scriptures where he preaches those things must have been things that have kind of been distorted. That's not really what Jesus said, that he was the one true Son of God. They also don't believe that Jesus Christ was crucified, because Islamic people believe that none of their prophets, if they're so holy and so devout to God, they could never die a hideous or a horrible death like crucifixion. So many Islamic people believe that Jesus was actually kind of switched out before the crucifixion, that he just rose up to heaven, and in his place on the cross, maybe died Judas, the one who betrayed Jesus, or maybe it was Simon of Cyrene, the man who carried the cross for Christ all the way to Golgotha. And then finally, their last prophet is Muhammad, who we've already talked about. So those are some of the beliefs that we share in common about the prophets and main people in the Bible. There's just a few more things I want to share with you. Also, their writings are very similar to our writings. They believe in a lot of the same writings of the Jewish faith and the Christian faith. They believe in the Torah of Moses. They call that the Torah. They believe in the Psalms of David called the Zabur. And they believe in the Gospel of Jesus found in our New Testament called the Injil. But the interesting thing to understand is they believe that wherever those scriptures contradict or go against or say something different than the Quran, that that must be a point in history where those writings were corrupted or were changed or were altered or edited in some way. Things like what they believe about Abraham and Ishmael versus Abraham and Isaac, what we believe, or the things that Christ said about him being one with Christ, one with God, and being the actual Son of God. Those are things they believe have been altered or kind of corrupted. And then their most holy book is what's known as the Quran. And they believe the Quran is the actual words of Allah that were written down in heaven in Arabic on tablets of stone. And they believe that these words that God wrote down up in heaven, he spoke them to Muhammad over the last 23 years of his life, trying to give Muhammad the message that was from heaven so that he could then proclaim it to all his people living in the Arabian Peninsula. Muslims believe that the Quran is infallible, literal, and authoritative. And they believe that the only real, authentic, authoritative translation of the Quran is in Arabic. I have a copy of the Quran right here, and this is more of a Western version of the Quran. If this was an Eastern Quran, it would be simply in Arabic only. There would be no English, no other language in it. But this copy of the Quran that I have has English on one side and then it has Arabic on the other, and then it's got some commentary all throughout it. If you were to strip away the dual languages and all the commentary, it would be about the same size as our New Testament. It's a book that can be read, that can be memorized. It's not too huge in size. But again, they would believe that if you were a Western person and you read the Quran in this way, it would be kind of like you were less than a devout Muslim who believes you should read this and understand this and memorize this book in Arabic. So that's one of the differences between Western Muslims and Eastern Muslims today. But they believe that this book is the word from God of where they need to govern their religion. And also many of the Muslims, where they live in a country where they have more Muslims than any other faith, they make this book also be their civil book, their government book, or the laws of the land. The Quran becomes both religious and civil. Now, many people believe that Muhammad actually wrote the Quran, and that's not true. The Quran was actually written 100 years after Muhammad's life. There was these leaders that succeeded Muhammad. They were called the caliphs, and the third caliph was Uthman, and it was actually he who recorded all the sayings and all the words of Muhammad that make up the modern-day Quran today. So they don't believe that Muhammad wrote it, but they believe it was the message and the words that Muhammad spoke from God. So that's what the Quran is. One final book I want to talk about is the Hadith. And the Hadith is very much like the Talmud to the Jews. It's just the commentary, the extra sayings, the extra words, the extra ideas that Muhammad spoke and some of the other Islamic leaders that were not recorded in the Quran. So that'd be a secondary book that they would add to the Quran as well. They share another belief that we share, the Day of Judgment. They believe there will become a Day of Judgment when you'll stand before Allah and you will be judged. And you'll be judged according to your good deeds and your bad deeds, like those angels we talked about who were recording that. And if you had more good deeds than bad deeds, if you followed the Quran and the will of Allah, then you would enter into paradise. And paradise would be a place of pleasure and joy and ecstasy for the rest of your life. However, if you had more bad deeds and you disobeyed the Quran, if you disobeyed the will of Allah, then you would go and live forever in a place of eternal punishment and damnation and suffering. So that's what their beliefs about the Day of Judgment are. Then finally, the last thing, overall, they believe that every follower of Allah must submit to his will. In fact, the word Islam literally means submission. It means submitting to the will of Allah. So over everything, they believe every follower must submit to Allah and whatever it is that he asks them and wants them to do. So those are the basic beliefs of mostly all Muslim people around the world. It varies just a little bit if you're Eastern versus Western, but those are the core beliefs that they have. Now I want to move on to what a Muslim person would show in their faith, how they would act out their faith, the practices, the actions that they would have on a daily, weekly, monthly, yearly basis. The main part of this is called the five pillars of Islam. I want to share those with you. Number one, the first pillar is Shahada. Shahada is a saying that goes like this: there is no God but Allah, and Muhammad is his messenger or prophet. It just shows right up front this importance that they have and the belief in only one God, and then how important Muhammad is to them as God's most important messenger and prophet. And a good Muslim person would recite the Shahada every single day. It would be on their prayers every single day. The second pillar of Islam is what's called Salat. And this shows the importance of prayer to Muslim people. They believe very much in the power of prayer, so much so that they pray five times every single day. And when they pray, there's a proper posture for prayer. They have prayer mats that they kneel down on, and they face Mecca. No matter where they live in the world, they believe they're to face towards Mecca every time when they pray on these prayer mats. There are five times of prayer throughout the day, or usually in the morning when they wake up, somewhere around the lunchtime, somewhere in the afternoon around 3 o'clock at dinner time, and then right before they go to bed. This is something that we can learn from Muslim people. They're very devout in their prayers to God, in their time spent with God, so much so that they do this five times every single day. The next one, the third pillar of Islam, is zakat. And zakat is their belief that they're required to give 2.5% of all of their income to the poor, to the needy, to charitable organizations. This is kind of a way of having a welfare system based in their country so that everyone's taken care of, that no one goes poor and penniless throughout their life. The fourth pillar of Islam is something called Sa'um. And Sa'um is related to the month of Ramadan. How many, raise your hand if you've heard of Ramadan before. Many people have heard of that. Their calendar, the Arabic calendar, is a little bit different than ours. But Ramadan is a month, and it moves according to our calendar. But for this year in 2008, Ramadan is actually right now, from September 1st to September 30th, it's going on. And here's their belief, that during this time, Sa'um is where they need to rid themselves of earthly desires and pleasures and focus themselves on God. So what they do from sunrise to sundown, all the light hours of the day, they fast or do without food, drink, smoking, and sexual activity. That is amazing to me. For one whole month, they refrain from all these things during the light hours of that entire month. Kind of shows how devout they are to their beliefs. And then the fifth one, the fifth pillar, is called a Hajj. And a Hajj is a special trip that every Muslim person is required to make at least one time in their lifetime. And they're to travel back to Mecca, that most holy place, and they're to go to where the Kaaba stone is, and there they're to go through some specific rituals and traditions in this Hajj. If you look on the screen right now, you'll see a picture of what it's like during Hajj in Mecca. Look at the thousands upon thousands of people that are there. They're all filling up and spilling out into the mosque. And you'll see in the top right corner there that Kaaba stone. In the first picture, remember how large it was? Look at how small it looks now compared to everything else that's around it. So this is a very important thing for Muslim people. It's kind of like their final act of showing their devotion and their belief in the Islamic faith. So for someone who lives outside of the Middle East, this is a very difficult thing to do, to travel all the way back there, pay for that, and spend time there going through all the practices. So those are the five main pillars of Islam. There's one other Islamic practice that I want to talk about that's a word that's kind of come into a lot of controversy over the last few years. It's the word jihad. How many of you have heard the word jihad before? A lot of you have. It was in the news, especially a lot around 9/11. We as Americans came to believe that this word jihad meant like a holy war, that Islamic people were waging a war against all other believers around the world. Well, what the word jihad literally means is to strive to get rid of, to eliminate, to destroy evil within oneself and within the world. And the way that this word is interpreted varies differently between American and Western Muslim people and Eastern or Arabic Muslim people. Muslims that live here in the United States or that live in Europe, in the Western part of the world, they would believe that jihad is not a literal thing, not a physical thing where they're to destroy other people, but instead it's more of a spiritual thing. It's more something internal and it's personal, that you would have a jihad with yourself. You would try to destroy all evil that wars inside of your heart and inside of your soul. But an Eastern Muslim person, more of a Middle Eastern Arabic type person, and especially a lot of the Shiite Muslims who we're going to talk about in a minute, they would believe that this is more of a physical thing. It's more of a literal thing, and that it's their job, it's their calling, their purpose from Allah, that they are to wipe out all evil in the world, even if that means destroying other people, destroying other countries and nations. If there's other nations that are evil and are separate and are bringing filth and destruction into the world in their eyes, then they believe it would be their calling to eliminate all of that. And that would be based on this belief of jihad. So that gives you kind of an understanding of what most all Muslim people would believe, whether or not they're in America or outside of America. I want to close by giving you an understanding of where Islam is in the world today, where we live today, where they live, where they're located. Because I think most of us think that the Muslim faith is just mostly amongst all Arab people, that it's mostly Middle Eastern people. And that makes sense because that's where it started with Ishmael and then with Muhammad and down through the Saudi Arabian Peninsula. But in fact, today, the Islamic faith has grown way outside of the Middle East. Non-Arab Muslims outnumber Arab Muslims 3-1. Countries like the Philippines, Indonesia, Pakistan are almost all Muslim with over 100 million followers of the Muslim faith. You'll see on this map right here kind of a description of where the Muslim people live in the world today. You'll see in Africa, parts of the Middle East, and then working over east into Pakistan, and then down in Indonesia and the Philippines as well. In fact, if you look at the continents, there's 69% of all the Muslims live in Asia, 27% in Africa, 2.5% in Europe, only 0.5% living in North America, and only 0.1% living in South America. So this helps you to see this is very much an East versus West thing. Almost all the Muslim people live in the eastern part of our known world, whereas much of Christianity is in the western part of the known world. And so that's why there's this struggle that's been going on for thousands of years between East and West, between Christians and Islamic people, and it continues on till our day. In the Islamic faith, there's two main branches. There's the Sunnis and the Shiites. And this is what we're going to wrap up by talking about this. You can kind of understand these two groups within the Islamic faith. The Sunnis are the majority of Muslims around the world. 85% of all Muslims are of the Sunni faith and the Sunni branch. They elect their religious leaders based on consensus, kind of like in a democratic way. And they also separate the religious part of their authority from the civil part, kind of like a separation between church and state, the same way that's similar here in the United States of America. And they view the Quran as their authoritative source of guidance, of what they're to believe, what they're to follow, what their laws are based on. And their authority is all based on the Quran. If one of their elected leaders would speak against the Quran or different than the Quran, then they would have that leader removed because they believe what the Quran says goes. The Shiites are a little bit different, and they're a smaller group. They're about 15% of all Muslims today are Shiites, and most of them live in Iran or around Iran. They elect their leaders based on the bloodline and the descendants of Muhammad, and then ultimately all the way through Ishmael. So there's no democratic election for that. If you're in that bloodline, then you're going to be the one that's going to be the next leader. And the political and religious authority is together. Church and state is one. It's not separated. It's all united and together. And they view those religious leaders as the source of authority. In other words, if one of the descendants of Muhammad, one of the descendants of Ishmael, who's the elected leader at that time, says, you know what, I know the Quran says this, but God has given me a vision or guidance or a message, and it's different or separate or in addition to the Quran, then they would believe they would have to follow that leader, that prophet, much like they followed Muhammad from the very beginning. So that gives you an understanding of the difference between those two main branches within the Islamic faith today. So overall, I find it interesting that we as Americans, although we don't know a whole lot about Muslim people and Islamic people, we just assume that they're kind of all Arabs, that if you're a Muslim, you must be an Arab. What I want you to understand now as we close, that that's very similar to the way that they view us. They view everyone who lives in the United States must be a Christian because we claim to be one nation under God. We act like we're a Christian nation. I want to have you watch one final video. This is a speech that was given at a missionary conference last year. One of our missions pastors went to this conference, and he got me a copy of this speech that was given there. Listen to this speech.
Assalamu alaikum. Wa alaikum assalam. I am a Muslim. My name is Mustafa Khan. I'm not a Christian. I'm a follower of Islam and the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. I am only one of a billion such followers in this world. My wife and I have been asked to come and to tell you about our faith and about our impressions of Christianity in this great Christian country of yours. I am from Kashmir, but first I am a Muslim. You see, religion and society are one. You cannot separate the two. Why, the very word Muslim means one who is submitted to God. As I have traveled this great Christian country of yours, I have come to see things that disgust me. I have found that Christianity produces 80% of the world's pornography. It is Christians in this great Christian country of yours that elect Christian leaders that say, homosexuality? Oh, koi baat nahi, no problem. Oh, you don't want that baby in the womb. Oh, you simply do one thing, you simply kill it. But my friends, this is a man's perspective. And one of the harshest criticisms of Islam is the way we treat our women. You say you treat your women like property. Well, I would very much like you to meet a piece of property in whom I love and cherish. My wife, Hasina, and she too is a Muslim, but she is from the Philippines.
Assalamu alaikum. As we traveled your country, a lot of people asked me, what do I feel about wearing the veil? I said, my feeling is not important. Allah said in the Quran to lower your gaze and guard your modesty. Should I have other opinion contrary to Allah? This would be prideful for myself. Also, a lot of women ask me, what do I think about American women? I tell them the truth. I say they embarrass me. Seems to me American women are obsessed with sex. Your magazines, your televisions, and even your films are full of naked women and sex. Your young women flaunt their bodies as they walk in the street naked. Also, you Christians said you believe in one God. I can't believe it, because I've seen you worshiping your American idols, Carrie Underwood, Britney Spears, and Madonna, the ultimate Christian woman, taking on Jesus' mother's name, wearing a cross around her neck and dancing in her underwear. This is Christianity.
Acha, shukriya. In the time that I have been in your country, many of you have come to me and said, Mustafa Khan, welcome to America. You're going to hell. Well, my friends, I tell you, it is the belief of myself, my wife, and a billion other people around the world that it is not we who are going to hell. It is you, your religion, and your society that has already gone to hell. Let us pray. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, the compassionate and the merciful. Amen. I have one more thing to say. My name is not Mustafa Khan. My wife is not Hasina Khan. My name is Matt Brandon, and this is my wife, Alu Brandon, and we are Workers with Frontiers. What you've seen is a perspective of a billion people, a generalization, and if you felt anger, if you felt something burning in you, I want you to look inside and say, how much of that am I defending is just sin?
That should be very convicting to each and every one of us. You see, we have our presuppositions and our ideas of what Islamic people are like, what we think about them. But what I wanted you to see there is that's what they think about us. We claim to be this Christian nation, but yet they see all the impurity, all the filth, and all the evil that leaves our country through our media outlets, through everything that we possess and send out to the rest of the world. And that's the way the Islamic people view us. We need to take a hard look at ourselves. And in fact, throughout this entire series, what we want to do is ask ourselves two main questions. The first question is this: how can we influence someone of Islamic or Muslim faith? How can we reach out to them and be able to eventually share the message of Jesus Christ with them? Here's what I want you to hear today. The way we can do that is by living a life of moral and ethical purity. A Muslim person will never respect you, will never want to listen to you, or even hold on a conversation with you if they think you are all about what they consider evil in this world, or filth, or moral injustice, or impurity. So something we have to do is ask ourselves, what kind of life are we living personally? And then also, we need to not be afraid to apologize for our country and say, you know what, yes, there is some evil in our country. We're not perfect. We have a lot of things that we need to clean up and we need to change. Admitting those things will bring down the walls, bring down the hatred and the anger with an Islamic person and a person of Christian faith, and allow you that opportunity to eventually be able to share with them. The second question we're asking ourselves is this throughout the series: what can we learn from someone of Islamic or Muslim faith? What's something that they do that we can incorporate into our own faith with God, make us a more fully devoted follower of our God? I believe it's this: Islamic people are very devoted to following and serving their God and worshiping their God. Think about some of the things that we've talked about. The fact that they pray 5 times every single day. They're fasting during an entire month out of the year. Many of the Eastern Islamic people's devotion to be willing to even kill themselves in following what Allah says to them, what they believe. They are so devout in their faith and their following of God. How about us today? As Christians, how much do we pray with our God, a personal God who wants to have a relationship with us? How devout are we in trying to get rid of all the evil and the negativity that our culture places upon us, how often are we trying to get rid ourselves of that and connect with God and spend time with God? I want you to ask yourself those two questions and think about that as we close. Join me for just a moment of prayer. Either close your eyes, bow your heads, or just maintain a moment of silence as we talk to God as we wrap this up. Dear God, I thank you so much for your word, the Bible. I thank you for the stories, the history, the lessons that it gives us. How it lets us see that we have the same beginnings of people of Jewish faith and Islamic faith. As Christians, we were all on the same path. But God, we see that when your son Jesus came into the world, that's where the story changed. That's where people believe different things. And God, our will and our desire is to spread the message and the love of your son Jesus with the entire world. God, I pray that you'd help us to clean up our life, clean up our country, so that the rest of the world would be open to our example, that we would be a good role model of what your son Jesus Christ is to the rest of the world. So God, we worship you as the one true God, the King of the entire universe, and we thank you for your son Jesus. It's in his name that we pray. Amen.